Well,
Yeah.
yeah, it's an occasion when I get to talk to Jay Buxbaum. His company, Royal Kosher Wine, is, I thought it was, I don't know, I knew it was very large, and I knew that it was big, big, big in the U.S. But tell us what you just told me, tell our listeners, Jay, that it is the largest, go ahead.
It's the largest kosher, I'm sorry, it's the largest producer, distributor, and purveyor of kosher wines in the world.
In the
We
world,
are
can
in
you imagine?
17 different countries. We're in, yeah, over 17 different countries. We produce wines in about 19 countries, including France and Italy and Spain and now Portugal and even Greece now, and of course
Greece.
Australia, New Zealand, gosh, Chile, Argentina, you just name it. Probably the only wine growing country, Hungary, the only wine growing region and country we do not have wine from is Germany at this point. And who knows,
Oh,
that may
really?
come down the road.
That's
But
interesting.
there's a certain sensitivity because the Herzogs are Holocaust survivors. So there's a certain
Okay.
sensitivity to the, oh my gosh, like German wine, I don't know, so, but
I don't blame them, yeah.
we have 36 different wineries just from Israel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Hey, it's real. I mean, of course, we get all these different producers, specialty food and drink people and stuff like that. Israel's really branching out into all kinds of stuff, like hummus. I mean, what's the name of that brand of hummus? It's so good. Chocolates. I mean,
Sabra.
whoever thought of kosher chocolates, you know,
Right,
or
right.
Israeli chocolates.
Well, what's interesting about that is that people ask me all the time. You asked me before we got on, started recording. People ask me all the time what makes wine kosher, and a
Yes.
lot of people don't realize that, there's a big difference between kosher food products and kosher wine. Kosher food products is always a matter of ingredients. Okay, so the ingredients within the product,
And
whether it be
production.
cookies, yeah,
Production
but
too.
yeah, production too, but the primary difference between kosher wine and kosher food is the ingredients in kosher foods have to be kosher. In kosher wine, the ingredients in kosher wine are similar, if not the same, to non-kosher wine. It's the oversight that matters.
Yeah.
It's the fact that from the crushing of the grape until the bottle is sealed, a rabbi oversees the production, and his objective is, a lot of people think he's there to bless the wine. It's quite the contrary. He's there to keep blessing out of the wine, because of old pagan ritual that used to occur thousands of years ago when they used to bless wine for the pagan ritual whites. He's there to make sure the wine is neutral and that you, the consumer, whether you're Jewish or not, make the wine special. So that's the difference
Interesting.
between, yeah,
That's
quite.
really interesting. We were talking also about how expansive the whole program is now, that you can get the best kosher wines in the world without compromise. And I told you that horrible incident where the only thing I could find, even in Manhattan, was kosher sangria, which was
Well,
not great.
that was my fault. I didn't know any better.
Well, but that's all they had at the time.
I think the bottle was bigger. I got the biggest bottle off the shelf.
So explain why everything's expanded. I mean, I'm curious, how did Royal Wine get to be so big and such a dominant force? And what has inspired all this expansion of production?
Well, the first thing, our core raison d'être, if you will, is to service and serve the kosher consumer. So, and we're not shy about that. We want to make sure that the kosher consumer has the absolute best wine they can drink because they are kosher. And so we go out and we make sure that we source the best grapes, the best wineries, the best of everything. The best corkage, the best winemakers, you know, the best equipment to make the wine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the family started making wine in 1848 in Czechoslovakia. In fact, in those days, the wine that they made was not kosher. They did make a small batch for themselves because they were strictly kosher, but most of the wine they made was for the general public and not necessarily under certification. Today, in America, they came here. First of all, beautiful story. They were protected and hidden by their own Gentile workers, you know, staff hid them for 2 years. And finally, they were able to, you know, emerge out of their hiding places and come to America with virtually nothing. And Jonah Herzog, Reb Yonah, started working for a small wine company on the Lower East Side, making, you know, like you remember, that sweet kiddish, sweet kiddish stuff, you know, that sweet sacramental wine. But he remembered the drier, better wines that he made for Rakoczy and for the, you know, in Czechoslovakia, and started looking for. First, he got some Asti from Italy. Then he got some Bordeaux from France, some basic Bordeaux from France, and then started making California, you know, basic California Cabernet, Chardonnay, and Chenin Blanc. Well, today we have Grand Crus from some, you know, from Léoville and from Chateau Clark and from Las Combes and from, you know, God, so many wonderful different wines, and from Rothschild. So, you know, there are wines now from New Zealand, some of the best wines from New Zealand. In fact, one of our biggest wines is Bartonura Moscato, which we guesstimate is probably 85% of the sales are not to kosher consumers. So the first and foremost, even though our core, you know, raison d'etre, so to speak, our core cause is to address the kosher consumer, more and more non-Jewish, non-kosher consumers are drinking the wines that we produce and purvey throughout the United States. And Israel,
because of the quality available.
Yeah, because of the quality, nothing else. And Israel is a great example of that. More and more, there's probably now somewhere between 300 and 500 restaurants that are not kosher throughout the United States that are carrying some or many of our Israeli portfolio of wines.
Well, that's a lot.
In your state alone, Zahav, which was rated one of the best restaurants, if not the best restaurant in America several years ago, has 5 of our wines on their list.
Wow.
Now, Herzog is the family.
And it is not kosher. I'm sorry?
Hold on. Herzog is the name of the family.
That is correct.
Okay.
Well, you know...
somebody's calling you. They have some wine. They want you
not
to
in
up.
My... Not. It's not. It's not on my side.
But, so, I mean, how do you market to this? I mean, how do you identify your consumers and market to them?
So... You know, as is the case with many communities, there are centers of Jewish communities throughout the country that are much richer in kosher consumers. So, for example, New York and New Jersey is one area. Southern Florida is another area. Southern California is another area. Chicago is an area. Baltimore. You know, the area in Maryland around Baltimore is another area. And in those areas, we have extensive distribution. But what's interesting is that it, even in Texas, you know, which is a very religious community, and I'm not talking about a Jewish religious community, a very, you know, Christian
Bible Belt,
religious community.
Isn't it?
Yeah, the Bible Belt, they're buying tons of Israeli wines.
Why?
Not as Jewish, because it's from the Holy Land. It's from where Jesus walked on water, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and so they want the wine from the Holy Land. And so we have that consumer as well. But again, it really comes down to what is in the bottle. Is it quality? And I have to tell you, you know, on occasion, we don't get it right. And, you know, not every wine is perfect, but, you know, our objective, and Morty Herzog, our CEO, put it right, you know, a long time ago we talked about what makes a boutique winery, and it's not just the fact that it's small. It's attention to detail and quality.
Sure.
It's attention to detail and quality. Yeah.
Now, here's a question for you, Jay.
Sure.
Are you the owners and growers of the grapes, or are you buying the grapes from somebody else, or are you blending from already vintage wines and mixing them all together? What's the program here?
That's a three-part question. The answer is that we're both. We have our own vineyards, especially in California, where we have our Herzog Wine Cellar, which is located in Oxnard with a wonderful, highly Zagat-rated restaurant. You should visit it. It's called Tierra Sur.
Okay.
And it's in Oxnard, it's in California. And we have there about 60% of our production is made from our own vineyards.
Wow.
So our California production for Herzog and Baron Herzog and Herzog Reserve wines are invariably, 60% of them at least, are made from our own grapes. But yes, we do buy grapes from other, from vintners and vineyards in both in California and throughout the world. We also, we never buy ready-made wines because kosher wines require that the oversight start at crush. So while we'll buy the grapes and we'll even make the wine in other people's wineries, we'll always have our crew there or a rabbinic crew there before the wine is crushed while it's still in grapes and while it's still being dumped into the hopper and into the crush, to oversee the production. So Bartonura is not made in our facility. We have a designated area within an enormous winery, and we have an enormous part of that enormous winery. And so we, purchase, as the grapes come in, our people oversee the production to make sure that it's all, produced under kosher certifying rabbinic oversight. And that is the case in all of our non-owned wineries. We do have another winery that we do own where we're, quote, vertically integrated, and that's in New York State, where all of the grape juice, we're the second largest grape juice producer in the United States. I mean, after Welch's, which is not kosher, the Kedem grape juice.
No wine either.
That's right. The Kedem grape juice, which is, probably getting close to 2 million cases, is produced all in our own winery. So while we do buy grapes for that, we buy the grapes in, raw, obviously, at harvest, and produce it from scratch after that.
See, that was my other question, because I'm so used to dealing with the food side of everything. My friend with a catering company has to be very careful where she prepares the food.
Right.
But these wineries, especially the ones that are not Jewish-owned, say, or Israeli-owned, or any variation of that, are the rules as strict, or can they produce other wines out of the same facility?
Great question. I'll give you one example of that. A very famous winery called Las Combes, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is a Grand Cru, Premier Cru, Classe Margaux. And what we do there, of course, they produce their own regular non-kosher cuvée. And in the same winery, in a designated area, with brand new designated tanks and brand new designated barrels, that are completely, overseen from the time the grapes are, picked in the vineyards. The rabbi is there. They bring the grapes to the winery. And from that moment on, the entire process is handled by an observant rabbinical crew. Now, it's
okay.
Under the tutelage and the direction of the master winemaker at Las Combes, but it is handled exclusively by the crew that, you know, the rabbinical crew, so that it remains kosher throughout.
Now, it's so amazing. Go ahead, Evan.
Now we're not nearly made a dent in the case you very generously sent to us.
Yeah.
But among the bottles that are in there are some very familiar sounding names of wines, and there are some that are not so famous. And let me preface what I was about to say with what I just said, because one wine that we've tried, we started it last night, is called Choreograph.
Right.
And there's another one called Lineage.
Right.
Is there anything about those? The reason they got those names?
Yes. There's a fascinating story about the Choreograph. About 10 years ago, maybe more than that, maybe 12, 13 years ago, we purchased a vineyard in Southern California. Well, not quite Southern California. I can't remember the AVA right now. But anyway, we purchased a very large vineyard, and one of the plots was an experimental plot. So, you know, there was a whole vineyard area for Chardonnay, and there was a whole vineyard area for Cabernet, and there was a whole vineyard area for Chenin Blanc, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then the previous vintner would test different little batches in a vineyard that was, I don't know, probably 20, 30 acres of different wines, of different grapes within the same vineyard. Well, the first year they didn't know what to do with this. You know, they wanted to rip it out and put in all Chardonnay or Cabernet. But the first year they had all this grapes. What are they going to do with it? So they harvested it all at once. And most of it was red wine, but there was some wine white in it as well. And they harvested all at once, and they vinted it all at once. And so it was a blend of all kinds of different grapes. Well, it tasted so good that instead of putting it into something called, you know, Burgundy, red, they decided to give it a nomenclature, which is Choreograph, which means bringing everything together.
Oh,
kind of like,
okay.
Yeah, and so that's the story behind it, which is interesting because, it, you know, historically speaking, you know, 200 years ago in France, it was the vintners, it was the grape growers that made their own wine, and they just harvested. It was called a field blend in those days.
Yes, right.
It was called a field blend. Right, still called that, but most people don't. You know, now they separate each variety and then they blend them after the fact. And, you know, this is a true field blend. And that, you know, after we've kind of tweaked it, you know, over the years. So that's why it's called Choreograph. And Lineage is called Lineage in general, because that's more of a category of wines that we make at Herzog, because of the lineage of, we're in the ninth generation of making wines. The Herzog family is in the ninth generation of making wines.
Jeez.
So it's the lineage behind it. It's not just the grapes. It's the history and the attention to, you know, pedigree that goes into every bottle of Lineage that is made, whether it's Chardonnay, Cabernet, Choreograph, Sauvignon Blanc, you name it.
Yeah, or Herzog Reserve, Napa Valley, and Lake Country Cab. I'm looking at that line.
Oh, gosh.
We're saving that for some kind of incredible California steak.
You'll have it, and you'll really wonderful. The Lake County, especially, is now a new and very exciting region, stuck right between Sonoma and Napa.
Okay.
I think, you know, over time, of course, it doesn't have the pedigree or the name recognition, I should say, of either of those places yet. But I think over time, people will find that it has the nuances and the positive qualities of both of those areas. I think Lake County is going to become the next new hot area to make.
Can you spell
wine.
That?
Lake, L-A-K-E,
lake?
like a body
right.
of water.
L-A-K-E.
Right.
L-A-K-E,
okay.
Right. Lake.
Okay.
It's a county.
Oh,
right.
Okay. All right.
Very and good. It's an ADA. No. It's a new wine growing region.
What was I looking at just now? I was looking at Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, probably my favorite red wine.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful. I wish more people felt like you did.
Well, we should all thank Robert Parker, I understand.
That's true.
Robert Parker is credited with having discovered the super plummy wines of the Southern Rhone.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They've taken off like crazy. Now we here's an interesting story for you. We were at the Charleston, South Carolina, Food and Wine Festival, and one of the speakers was a member of the Perrin family.
Oh yeah, Perrin.
The current head of the Perrin family, and we listened to his presentation, which was very interesting. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, "How long would it take you to record that for our program?" And he said about 15 minutes. I said, sold.
There you go.
We did an exceptional interview with a man explaining why and what there was about his family that caused them to be able to make a great wine going back 5 centuries or longer.
Wow, 5 centuries. Wow.
And that's kind of amazing. But, you know, it's also amazing to me that the Herzogs could get to be this large. I mean, was there like a shortage of competition, or was it just smarts, experience?
No, I think it's very, very simple. You know, I think everything counts, you know. Not great competition, attention to detail. But I don't want to sound too religious, but, you know, very often, you got to, like, look at the one above, especially, as we know, as vintners, we know that you can't control everything. When it comes to grapes, it depends on, you know, whatever the heavens above give you in terms of quality, right? Mm-hmm. But I would say that you know, in an earthly way, it's really, really this ever-ending attention to quality. And I think that, you know, the concept of if you build it, they'll come. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was growing up, to buy, you know, kosher wine, if you had to spend more than $3 on a bottle of kosher wine, you're out of your mind, you know?
I know.
Now there are wines that, you know, especially these cru classés, etc., they're wines at hundreds of dollars a bottle. And you know what? Once you introduce a wine drinker to a better wine that's truly better, not just more expensive, I'm not talking about dollars-wise, but that tastes better and that sits better in the mouth and that goes better with the food, they ain't never going back to the cheaper stuff.
Yeah, well, a funny story is a friend of ours, Reuben Katz, was a wine connoisseur and a restaurateur with a number of very fine dining restaurants, and he ended up running the program through the CIA in, where is that, California?
San Angelina.
So anyhow, he wasn't paying the duty on importing. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, that was bad enough. He got caught. And on top of it all, poor Reuben, they confiscated, I mean, he truly loved his wines. They confiscated his wines from one of his restaurants and distributed the wines to nursing homes. And
oh my goodness.
On TV, they had all these old people coming on saying, I prefer me to Shabbos.
That's pretty funny.
That was not funny for Reuben. It was a very bad
I
lesson
guess not.
To learn.
I thought I caught a reference to a relatively new region in California, Paso Robles. So are you active there? I think you must be.
Oh, yes. In fact, we make a wonderful wine out of Paso Robles called Beleaf, B-E-L-E-A-F, which is completely organic. And what I'm so excited about, it's 100% Cabernet, comes from 100% organic vineyard, made without, you know, the addition of sulfites. Of course, your listeners need to know that there's always sulfites in wine because it grows in the ground. You know, there are sulfites in the ground
that
it comes from.
That.
So there's nothing you can do about that. But what's wonderful about it is in the past, people who have made organic or you know, sulfite-free wines have done it with compromise. This is a no-compromise quality organic wine. The wine is quite delicious, you know, very good, medium-bodied, you know, but full and rich and complex in flavors. So, yeah, and it's made out of Paso Robles from a vineyard there.
There are a bunch of really interesting people, winemakers and wine growers out there.
There's a gang you should get to know. They call themselves the Rhone Rangers.
Rhone Rangers, sure.
And they make white and red wines off the Southern Rhone, but they make them in Paso Robles. And
wonderful.
Apparently, it all resulted from the fact that there was one particular wine dealer who had been their exclusive importer of Rhone wines into the United States, and they looked everywhere there was in across the country, including several parts of California, to find the land which most reminded them of where they came from.
Interesting.
And that's where they established their vineyard, and it's called, oh God, it's something Creek. Tablas Creek. Tablas Creek is their wine label, and they make both a red and a white.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
It's interesting. They all did something else before. I mean, one was a hospital administrator. Another one was
a football player.
NFL retired football player. They came from everything. I guess this was, what do you call that when it's your dream company?
And there was a Frenchman.
And then there was a Frenchman who outgrew the restrictions of the bourbon.
And the Frenchman and Peter both liked cigars. So on the evening that we spent drinking their fine wines and eating their wonderful food, we finished up out by the pool.
Yeah. Well, that was in the past. We don't do that anymore. Thank heavens.
I think if we were there for dinner, we probably would, or I would.
I hear you.
Well,
don't forget your friend Jay Buxbaum the next time that happens to invite.
Right. Well, Jay, I wanted to wrap this up by making sure that our listeners knew how to find out where they could get your fine wines.
Do you have a website?
On the website. Let's do the website.
Oh, sweetheart.
Herzog.
I had one question I wanted to ask before we close. Go ahead, Jay.
Okay.
With the website.
Herzog Wine Cellar, Cellars with an S or with it, without the S is fine, .com and royalwine.com. Royalwine.com.
I wanted
our listeners and ourselves, for that matter, to hear what the absolutely disastrous climate changes in California have done to the wine business.
Oh, what about the fires?
How long will it take you to recover?
Well, the fires. What's interesting about the fires is that even though it didn't hit the vineyards, the smoke taint. And the smoke taint made us literally skip an entire vintage.
Okay.
Really?
It's very scary in many areas. And it was very scary because, you can't run a business that way. I mean, you just can't. I mean,
I know.
And it was just horrible. I mean, our Napa, our Sonoma, our Alexander Valley, our, I mean, it was just horrible that so much of our best wines we had to literally skip a vintage on.
Will you sell them at all, or will you just rubbish them?
No, we didn't make it. The wine was no good. We didn't make it. The smoke taint, we harvested some, and then as it came in, we saw, well, I should say not me, I wasn't there, but the winemakers saw how bad, you know, how it was negatively impacting the must, and he said, forget it. We're not making wine this year of these vineyards. You know, not everything. Our Southern California, our Paso Robles was fine. You know, some of the areas, other areas were okay, but some of the best of our stuff, Napa, Sonoma, was just devastated.
So advice to customers would be stay away from 2022 California.
Well, you don't. Yeah, I mean, we don't have, if we have a 22, it's because it came from an area that was not affected. We will not. There's the example again of why you asked me before why we're successful. And again, it's, you know, from on high. But if you want to get down to earth, it's because we could have made wine out of that smoke tainted juice, but it wouldn't have been that good, and we just refused to do it.
Oh yeah, it would ruin your reputation as well.
Yeah, our reputation and our consistency, etc., is so much more important than, you know, than even the great loss that we had because of that.
Well, it was a great pleasure to talk to you once again.
Yeah,
and
pleasure's mine.
Be able to share your story with our
listeners
across the country. There's one name that didn't come in up in the conversation, and it was really rather interesting, and may or may not remember this, but we went when we were staying with our nephew at his house in not too far outside Oxford. One of the things we did on a day off, was to go to the Rothschild Country Estate.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Where they were selling Chateau Lafite in the cellar.
Wow.
Yeah.
Will you one day be as large as they are?
I'm not sure how large they are as privately held, but who knows? By the way, you know they're making kosher wine for us. The Rothschild family is now making kosher wine for us.
Right.
Good.
Well, that's great. They should.
They should indeed.
They certainly should. Okay, Jay Buxbaum of
Until the
Royal
next time.
Wine. Until we can talk again, keep us posted on your developments. You seem to be expanding every time we talk, more so.
Yeah,
anyhow,
it's
a pleasure
so
as always. Okay, Jay. Jay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye now.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Yeah, so we're talking to DJ Rasich, and he has, I wanted to clarify with you, DJ, your company, I have two different terms for it. One is Deep Love, and the other one is Deep Water USA. Which is what?
Yeah, the Deep Water USA is the actual company.
Okay.
And the Deep Love is the brand, which is the head brand. So we have the head brand of Deep Love, and then we have the sub-brands, which are, you know, the beverages, which we can discuss them down the road. But Deep Love is the brand name.
Okay, well, what else does Deep Love make?
Well, Deep Love makes right now mainly floral lemonades, and we have three flavors. And these flavors, they have the sub-brand name just to, you know, kind of give it a little extra kick. And it's one is Deep Rose. We have a second one, which is Deep Elder. And the last one is Deep Vault. But
so what does the other company make? The Deep Water USA. What is that company?
That company owns Deep Love. So Deep Love is just the brand. It's the brand name that we have. And the Deep Water USA is the company that owns Deep Love. Or it's basically the company name. Yeah.
Okay. Great. And where is the company based? You said before
Miami.
Before we came on the air, you're now on the West Coast just visiting. But
yeah.
Home base is Miami?
Yeah, it is Miami, yes.
Okay, well, now, it seems to me that it was serendipitous for you to come up with this. Describe how you came up with this company and what led you to develop this product.
Well, it's, I love to travel, and I love to take my family all over the world. My background is international. I am ethnically Middle Eastern, grew up in Germany, and then came to the U.S. To study and get my degrees in business finance. So for many years, as time passes, I was preoccupied with family, of course, and then with my investments, which were mostly in the financial sector. However, from young on, I was very entrepreneurial. I wanted to make an actual product rather than shoveling money around and trying to make money out of that. So there was always this idea of, some import, export, some manufacturing, to make something. And it happened to be a few years ago, 7-8 years ago, I traveled, to Istanbul in Turkey. And I went and visited the famous Hagia Sophia, which is an absolute monstrosity of building. It's a phenomenal building. Anybody should really go and look at that, which
huge.
Was built, it was built in the 7th century by Justinian. It was part of the Eastern Roman Empire. And just to bring it in, I have a master's degree in history, ancient, Near East, and modern European. So I have enormous interest for these structures. So I go over there, and I sit at a little gift store, and I tried this lemonade, and I tried this drink, and it was rose water infused. And as I was trying this out, I say, this is really something very pleasurable. It is very unique. It is something that it's part of the Middle Eastern culture to use rose water for ingredients, for food, for beverages. And I knew about that. And then when I got back to the U.S., I started researching more and about the company that was making the drink. And I found out that peculiar drink, they went back and traced what the ancient sultans used to drink. And they tried to reformulate it and bring this product out there into the market. And then I started researching, and I said, okay, it's a fantastic drink, but there are problems with the drink. It is, number one, it has to be, changed to American-based, and we have to also do the branding and the marketing and the packaging. All of that has to be changed. You can't just, let's say, talk to the company in Turkey and say, let's import your product and let's, sell it. It's not going to do well. So as more I researched, I decided, I said, let's do this. Let's, create a beverage company, and let's connect that to my background, which has a lot to do with history and traveling, and bring these ancient tastes and floral elements, especially, to the modern world. Let's make beverages, and the influences by, let's start out with floral elements, and let's make beverages that have those elements. And I started, talking to a lab, and we kept on, researching and going back and forth and tried to get the formula right. And at the end, we made a lot of changes. We created a totally new beverage that has a lot of health aspects into it. But I don't want to, the health aspects being I wanted to make a beverage that is low in calories. It has 50 calories and less. And that has all natural ingredients, that has real rose extracts in it. Because a lot of beverages, they call it certain names, but the actual ingredient is not there. So we wanted to introduce the actual ingredients into the beverage, and we finalized the formula. Then came the idea, well, how are we going to sell this product? How is it going to be branded? Because if it's out on the shelves, people walk by, they're not going to buy it. So researching further and going through a lot of ups and downs with the manufacturing and the bottling part and everything, the result is what you see now on our website, which is straightforward, drinkdeeplove.com. And what came out of this product is ultimately what you see today. It is a product that is unique in its taste, very floral. It is, the coloring is beautiful, especially on the deep rose, which is the rose-flavored lemonade. When you pour it into a flute, the pink color comes out. It is the design, a very sleek bottle, glass bottle with a metal cap on it. And all of this is fantastic. I believe it's a fantastic product. It tastes very well. But how am I going to get the consumer basically to buy it? And the idea was basically, okay, we are dealing here with floral elements. We're dealing with an all-natural product, 50 calories, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to combine all of this with love, because floral elements, especially our first flavor, deep rose, has everything to do with love. It's all about love. Love comes in many ways. Love with your family, love with your partner, love with so many directions. And roses and floral elements totally are part of that. And so I wanted to combine that, and this is why the word deep love comes in. This is the head brand. And it is deep love, and I created a slogan, which is basically, ever wondered what love tastes like? And this slogan is what is printed on the trays, printed on our bottles. This is our slogan for our product. And this is what actually, you know, draws the consumer to the product, because it's asking a question. So once the consumer goes to the product, they taste it and they like it. Because we've been now around 3-4 years, we started out with the actual sales. And we put it out in the stores, and we noticed that there was a really good reception. And I heard from a lot of companies and a lot of people that the product is selling very well. And very quickly, we were able to land some anchor stores. I'm not sure if I can name any company, but these are large national specialty food chains. And I heard very positive feedback. So we were able to very quickly add a lot of specialty stores throughout the country. We got a lot of demand, a lot of interest for the product. And of course, then COVID hit, and we didn't know what was going to happen. And it didn't hurt us as much. We started growing further. But with this process, when you're trying to add a lot of anchor stores, the big companies, there's a long process until you actually get onto their shelves. It can take 1 to 2 years. So we noticed the effect of COVID really last year. Because a lot of these companies, they make the decision once a year, and due to COVID, they really didn't want to take new brands on. And so, but since it takes 1 to 2 years before you get into the shelves, so the effect of COVID really hit us last year, where we noticed it was very hard to really get larger anchor stores interested in our product. But we are noticing this year that it's starting to pick up a lot more. We have a lot more interest. And just to jump back, you know, our first flavor was Deep Rose. This is how the entire story started. And now we have two more flavors, which we can discuss in a little bit down the road. But I think I covered pretty much in a lot of detail how the product came by. Yeah.
Well, I mean, are you promoting it primarily in terms of function or taste or a health benefit or what?
It's a product that, you know, we believe has a lot of positives and a lot of ways to promote. The main promotion is really the love part. Mm-hmm. It is a beverage that you really, it's a life experience. It's a functional. Functional beverages also have an aspect, not only the health aspect, but they have the aspect of a general well-being. So part of a general mental health being is when you sit with your friends and your children or whoever, loved ones, and you open our beverages and you enjoy it with your family, and then you take a moment and you zip in that beverage. So it's not a beverage that you just like, you know, like drink it in 2 seconds and it's done. No, it's part of, you know, the lifestyle. It's kind of like a lifestyle beverage that is combined with the love aspect and the side effects of the beverages, of course, because it has, you know, the floral extracts in it, that it has health benefits. We know about rose extracts, elderflower extracts, you know, they have a lot of antioxidants.
Exactly.
And others. Yeah.
Well, of course, the rose, I mean, anytime you're cooking Middle Eastern food, you go and you buy rose water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it has the benefits, but, you know, as I said, everything is part of marketing, part of, you know, how is the consumer reacting.
Exactly.
And you don't want to, you know, and the love aspect is where we really see a very positive response to it, and this is the direction we are going on, the main point, yeah.
Now, I think you'd do well doing seminars on how to market entrepreneurial products.
Well,
you do that.
I think, you know, my background is really, I'm very, you know, I think it's maybe part the upbringing in Germany, and there's a, you know, as we can, if you want to be stereotypical, there's a certain nature of being very straightforward and very correct and very detail oriented. And my background is in that organizational part, and I could literally, yes, I mean, the beverage, you know, I've never had dealt with beverages. I was never in that industry. I had literally no clue what I started. But I'm a quick learner, and I watch the numbers, and, you know, I think I'm doing pretty well with the company. So.
you started to say something, Peter.
Did I start to say something? I meant to. We talked with someone just a few weeks ago who had a line of beverages, not the same as Deep Love, but they felt like their position in the marketplace was to attack the base of drinks that most Americans drink, which is carbonate, one carbonated and
yeah.
two ultra sweet. And
they saw
a place in the middle of the market, if you like.
That
had the characteristics that you're describing for your product.
Yeah. I mean, it's things develop, and you know, plans for the future are, because the brand is doing very well and the idea is doing very well, we are planning to enter separate markets. I mean, we have, you know, the beverage right now, it's a premium beverage. It comes in a glass bottle. It has the metal cap on it. It's expensive to make and very hard to make, and especially shipping. I mean, shipping is really thing that is almost killing us right now, because these are very heavy items. You know, to ship the empty bottles across the country and then have them bottled in, you know, we're bottling in Utah, and having a pallet that weighs 1,700 pounds go to the, let's say, East Coast, it is just a killer. And so, and plus
and
the market...
Encountering breakage, I mean, you insulate these very well. I mean, very fully. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you have all these difficulties, and the specialty market is a very limited market. I mean, it's not many, you know, people go to a specialty store because at the prices, they are generally expensive. But for us and for me, it's a perfect entry point to get the product out, to get the branding out, and to see how the reaction is. Of course, we have plans down the road to enter the canned version of this beverage. In a can.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, aluminum cans. So
that won't have the same attraction, though, because, I mean, half the attraction is the color.
Of course. I mean, everything, but then you're hitting a totally different market segment. You see, you're going to the mass markets, and when you go to the mass markets, you know, I cannot sell, you know, at a general store a beverage for $3.99 so easily. I mean, I can sell it in these high-end specialty stores, there's no problem. But if you want to go to the mass supermarkets, it's going to become very hard to sell it for $3.99. But if you can get it in a canned version, and we believe the branding is really what is attracting the people, and once they get the branding, you know, and you're offering it, let's say, at $1.99 at a different version, it's going to attract a much larger crowd. I mean, it's it's kind of like, you know, to compare that to, let's say, sugar and healthy food. You know, the entire country or everybody is promoting lifestyle, healthy food, low sugar. But when you look at the market share, low sugar drink are basically, it's almost like a joke. It's such a slim number.
Is that
everybody
true?
Is drinking. Yeah,
really?
The majority. I mean, well, when you look at, you know, what is selling, Coca-Cola, well, if I can mention these companies, but we all know the companies. When you look at their beverages, you know, they have 100, 120, 150 calories in it. You know,
yeah,
and when you look at some large coffee retailers out there and chains, and we know that company, when you look at what people order there, it's all highly sugared with high calories. That's where the masses basically go.
Now, what about this? You have to be helped by this non-alcoholic movement, the temperance movement.
Yeah. This is why the beverage, again, you know, the beverage has a lot of advantages, actually, besides, you know, the sleek design, the taste, and the love aspect of it, and the antioxidants and everything. It comes to that experience again, you know, because the beverage is so unique. When you sit at a counter, let's say the bar or restaurant or wherever, this is a beverage that literally when you put it on the counter, especially when you lit it up, because the colors really, the pink color comes out beautifully, and you pour it into a flute or into a cocktail glass, and you smell it and you see the colors, it is a beverage that could be very nicely had in a bar and enjoy the cocktail aspect without alcohol in it. So it's perfect actually for that.
Right. Now you pick probably one of the tightest niches in the specialty food. I guess maybe snacks would be worse, but beverages, it's so densely crowded that niche in specialty products, food. I mean,
well,
your competition is huge.
No, I mean, of course, it's a tough market. It's crazy to enter the market. But as I said, you know, I'm very entrepreneurial. I don't give up. I keep on poking and I keep on trying. And sometimes life happens to happen the way it happens. I mean, I run into the place in Istanbul. I really love the idea. And first, you don't think about, you know, how tight and how hard that market segment is. You just first, you become emotionally involved into this product. And once you become emotionally involved and you're a part in it, you know, there's no way I'm going to give up. You see, that's it.
You're funny.
Yeah, it's, you know.
No, I mean, how does the industry accept you? I mean, are you welcome in this densely crowded niche market of beverages?
I think I'm doing pretty well. I mean, we're in almost 800 stores. We've had a lot of interest overseas. You know, just to give an example, we had a very large chain, which is quite, because I believe the drink, you know, going back to the Middle East now as an American version would do phenomenal. And I had a very large chain in Saudi Arabia, Dubai, and all those countries actually ordering the product.
Yeah,
but
that'd be perfect.
Unfortunately, what happened is that they're really fighting obesity in those countries now.
Oh,
and the
right.
government is really going against sugar. So any drink that has any sugar gets a 50% tax on top of the final retail price.
What?
So basically,
I never heard that.
Yes, it started around a couple of years ago, and it's in Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and those countries. They introduced that, and that basically killed my beverage. So that's why I am planning to come out with a different version that is, you know, where I can avoid the sugar. But, I had interest overseas. I have enormous interest in Latin America. But again, there's a price issue. It's
yeah,
a high price product.
Latin
America, you know, the average income there is limited,
yeah,
and
yeah.
is a high. It's just not the market there. It's just you know, and even in the U.S., the market is very limited. I mean, people have this idea. When I started in this business, I thought, you know, selling tons of this product, a certain amount was just expected, but actually you're very happy with, you know, the numbers are lower than what I thought at the beginning, what is possible out there with these kind of products. Mostly, you know, when you go to a supermarket, it's really, I don't know what the percentage is, but there's a very low percentage that does a vast majority of business. And they are most SKUs that are in a supermarket they do very low, but a lot of it in specialty stores you do because you have that client that specifically comes to buy our product in that store,
right.
And hopefully they'll buy other things. That's the idea behind it. This is why we have specialty stores. They're not a chain,
right.
A major chain. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you also do, you have a charitable activities, initiatives. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm supporting my background again. I was born in Afghanistan. And
you were
left
born
when
where?
I was
in Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And,
okay.
Yeah, and then my family moved in the 60s.
Wait, I'm losing you. I'm losing your sound. Can you talk?
Can you hear me?
You speak directly
Hello?
Into. Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. Can you? Yeah. So, yeah, in the 60s, my family moved to Germany, and I was, you know, and then I grew up there. And so I have a certain interest for the country, of course. And so what I'm doing is I'm helping girls' education or children's education in Afghanistan. And the company
Holy.
Is supporting.
Holy Moses. That is a job. Hello?
Well, it's, yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, now. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, you tackled a big problem there.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm not, you know, engaged on a daily basis, but I'm supporting an organization that, you know, has connections and direct contacts there and specifically sponsoring children. So this is the charitable part of the company and what I like to do, yeah.
Well, that's good. So, what direction are you going to head in? You already said you're going to probably do more accessible packaging.
Yeah.
Are you going to do more flavors or what?
It's right now. The goal is, you know, if I can say, the canned version. However, I can't do that until there are plans to, you know, the canned version is really the main planning here. And I do, I'm working on a coffee line, actually.
Coffee.
So, which should come out soon. There are certain reasons why I do the coffee. I don't want to, you know, go into too much detail on that. But
right.
And it's going to have the same ideas behind it again, the same slogan, marketing, the packaging. And it's going to be rose infused. One of it is going to be rose infused. I'm planning to bring one out with German chocolate, you know. And I'm
Oh, right, roses
right
and chocolate. Yeah, great.
Yeah, so,
well,
you know, this is what I'm working on this year.
Yeah, well, and I think you caught on an idea here, and that's great, and you seem raring to go. The best way for people to get this product, do you have a store locator online?
No, it's not a store locator. I don't know. Can I mention my companies? That would be, you know, the easiest to do. Can I?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so basically it's on the East Coast, the main chain, specialty chain we are in is the Fresh Market. So that's anywhere from like Chicago up to the Northeast, down to Florida, Georgia. So that's the area where, you know, if you want to get the product and you go to the specialty stores, that's the one big chain that you can go to. Then we have in the Rocky Mountain region, we have Whole Foods, but that's mainly in the Rocky Mountains area. We have Central Market around the Dallas, Houston area. We are very heavily in the Northeast, New York, Boston, Connecticut. And so I can't specifically tell you what stores, there are a lot of them. They're all small independent stores. You would have to just check. I mean, they're usually specialty farmers markets, specialty stores. We are heavily in those areas. We are also in the Chicago area, such as Pete's Fresh Market, Westmind, and there's, those are the ones there. And that I would say were, you know, Fresh Market, Whole Foods, everybody knows right away in those specific markets that I mentioned. And we are planning to move now to the West Coast more. If we've been doing business on the East Coast, the West Coast is not covered much, and we are having a big show next week. It's called Expo West in Anaheim. I believe it's one of the largest, or maybe the largest, food and beverage show, and we are going to exhibit there. So anybody that listens, you know, it's our booth number is N1251, and it starts on Wednesday till Friday. So we hope that during that show, we can grab some good contacts here on the West Coast and get going again.
Well, I wish you continuing expansion. Welcome your flow of ideas, of which you seem to be really generating at top speed here, and continue to grow. We're very happy to have met you and be able to talk to you, and enjoy the beauty of your product. I mean, it is a beautiful product, so that has its own appeal. Well,
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, it was great talking to you and understanding what's going on, and keep up the good work. Let us know if you have any major development you want to spread the word about.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to present my company today. Thank you.
Thank you, DJ. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.